Hi, this is Paul. A lot of the content I get from you, and a variety of you send me things on Twitter. You leave recommendations or links in the comments section. Sometimes you send me emails, and that's usually where I find this stuff. Now, you always have to kind of be careful about what you send me, because sometimes people send me things and they want me to be like, oh yeah, this is great. And then I actually find it interesting, but I'm kind of critical of it. And then I share with you what I think, and then sometimes people get mad at me because I wasn't the mook they thought I'd be. So I am what I am, and that's all that I am. But somebody sent me this. Actually, this is the second time more than one person has sent me someone from the Civitas or Kiwitas podcast, which is a fairly new podcast. It's got Peter Lighthart and James Wood. James Wood I'm going to get him on. He teaches up at Redeemer University, which is founded by a bunch of Christian Reformed people in Ontario as sort of a Canadian something where Canadian kids don't have to travel to Michigan over the border to Calvin College. And so Redeemer has they started they started in the 90s or so. You can correct me if I'm wrong in the comment section. But so James Wood is there, and he was a PCA minister. He was a church planter. He wrote a big thing about Tim Keller. He's been involved in the Winsome Wars, that kind of thing. And I'm going to have him on the show at some point, probably after Europe and things settle down, and probably when he doesn't have to grade papers or something like that. We'll have him on. And Peter Lighthart. Peter Lighthart is not someone that I've done a lot with on the channel, but he is, you know, I found out that he's in the same denomination as Doug Wilson, but he's a little different from Doug Wilson. So these two have a podcast about post-liberalism, and they had Nancy Piercy on, which was a podcast that I really enjoyed. That was episode 11. And now Bryce sent me this episode 12. And so there you go, Bryce. You get that achievement badge that you recommended a thing to PVK, and he played it. So this was a great conversation with Ross Douthat. And I was really helped by this because I probably hadn't heard someone express a lot of what I was thinking about this whole Christian post-liberal moment as Douthat has. And maybe that's because he works for the New York Times, and maybe that's because that's kind of the community that I, you know, longtime reader of the Times, and so, you know, sort of alienated in the whole thing that has happened in the last 8 to 10 years, but let's jump into it. Douthat begins by explaining how he looks at a bunch of the post-liberalism thing in terms of, actually, this is going to come up in my rough draft for Sunday this week too. I've already written most of it, but he looks at a lot of the people there, and he's just got a bit of discomfort about it because he thinks they're right in a number of ways, but finds that they don't seem to really have a viable thing to offer. And Douthat has just been saying he doesn't really have a solution either, but he's watching and he's paying attention and he's listening. And so then he starts to sketch out some of what he sees in terms of where we're at.
I have just a basic uncertainty from my own perspective, where my basic view is that there's sort of a limited form of liberalism, a procedural form of liberalism that tends to be a kind of container or vessel for some stronger view. And for most of American history, that stronger view was some form of Protestant Christianity.
Okay, this is very similar to that Tim Keller clip I play.
In other words, everybody was a nominal, 80-90% of people were nominal Christians. And because they were nominal Christians, they had a moral base, and they lived with the illusion that we're really not a Christian country, we're a secular country. But the fact is, they'd never really had to deal with pluralism
And that living with the illusion that we're a secular country was really handy in terms of a post-confessional war reformation place, because we could say, you can come here as a Jew, you can come here as a Muslim, you can come here as an atheist, you can come here from anywhere, and you're going to be fine because this is a secular country. It's open and it's welcome. But minorities of religious and various stripes very quickly got the sense that, okay, it's kind of open, but not really. I don't really have a place at the table. Jews couldn't join certain things and weren't taken seriously. Again, it wasn't really until the Roosevelt administration that you had Catholics and Jews really participating in government. And so, whereas it was ostensibly sort of secular and people could come in, you know, when the Irish Catholics came in, people were really bothered. And when people from, you know, Southern Europe came in, the Italians and the French and the Spanish and all these Catholics coming in, people were troubled. But ostensibly it was open, but everybody kind of knew the rules.
Using liberal democratic, structure. And when real pluralism came along, we found out we couldn't abide it. And so now here's the first thing that happened. The first group of people that actually moved away from liberal democracy into we're going to impose our worldview on you were the progressives. They were the first people.
Which is super interesting because, of course, the progressives are the heirs of the mainline WASPs who basically in the Roosevelt era came in charge, and they just kept working their program. But as Keller notes, they were the first ones to begin to say, you know, shouldn't really be open. I remember the congressional. It wasn't her Supreme Court. It wasn't her Supreme Court hearings, but the woman that Trump appointed to the Supreme Court. I remember when she was being interviewed for another judgeship, and Al Franken, you know, really went after her in terms of a religious test. And a bunch of people said, "Hey, wait a minute. The Constitution specifically demands that there be no religious test." Now, this book that I'm reading, American Nations, so you know, Mark LaFaber of Navigating Patterns gets an achievement for that, because Cale Zeldin, John Vervaeke, they've all, I bought books because of their recommendations, and Mark LaFaver said American Nations, which has been excellent. So it's a really complex story, but Keller is right.
People to start doing it. Rowan Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury, former, talks of, he calls it programmatic secularism rather than procedural secularism. In other words, it used to be the government was secular in the sense of being a neutral umpire and said, okay, you know, we want to make sure everybody has a you know, level playing field to make your case and live your lives. But programmatic secularism goes like this. If you, ex well, put it this way. In the 60s and 70s, even the 50s, if somebody wrote a book saying it's okay to be gay, that would probably be not publishable because it would be banned as obscene speech, right? Today, if you try to write a book or say it's not okay to be gay, now it's also condemned as obscene speech, except it's called hate speech. And what's happened is there was a kind of hegemony, it wasn't pluralistic, there was a kind of nominal Christian hegemony that really did run things. And when that fell apart, now we realize, well, who's going to get in charge?
Well, it didn't really fall apart. What it really did was morph. And increasingly after the Cold War, the Christian aspect of it got more and more uncomfortable. And so that got sort of pushed to the side, and a lot of the other beliefs just kept moving.
Charge of just the defining hate speech and obscene speech. And progressives said, we're going to do it. And so what they actually have done is they are imposing a kind of programmatic, hard secularism. And conservatives and Christians have seen that. They say, you know what, you're not being neutral anymore. You're really actually pushing. You're actually saying you have to keep your religion totally, totally private. when our religion doesn't allow that. Now, by the way, it's the same problem with Islam. So they're going to have the more Muslims that are here, the more problems they're going to have there too. But the issue is that conservatives are pushing back, wrongly, I think, and are saying, yeah, liberal democracy doesn't work. There's a lot of conservatives saying we need Christian nationalism. We actually need to get the state needs to be overtly Christian,
Now, Douthat's going to add a lot more nuance to this.
overtly Protestant, or there needs to be, the Catholic integralists say that the Catholic Church should be the state church. And what they're saying is there's absolutely no way to get that moral consensus. We're always going to be fragmented. Liberal democracy doesn't work. And it is a crisis because the fact is, as long as everybody was a nominal Christian, liberal democracy works, and it doesn't. We're not that way anymore. Liberal democracy undermined Christianity and religion in general and created this situation where we truly are divided. And now the old liberal democratic proceduralism doesn't bring us together. We're just at each other's throats. We have alternate views of reality, totally different views of reality.
My basic view is that there's sort of a limited form of liberalism, a procedural form of liberalism that tends to be a kind of.
So he's basically adopting the same language from Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, of procedural liberalism versus Keller called it procedural secularism versus programmatic secularism, and there's sort of procedural liberalism versus programmatic liberalism.
Container or vessel for some stronger view. And for most of American history, that stronger view was some form of Protestant Christianity. And a lot of what we've seen since the 1960s is a kind of, the emptying out, the draining away of a product of sort of Protestant center from American life, which leaves this kind of.
And of course, that Protestant center in American life was this amalgam. It wasn't a pope. It wasn't a church with a hierarchy. It wasn't, let's say, a state metropolitan. It was this interesting amalgam of Protestantisms that together sort of held this together. They were constantly battling. There's sort of a Protestant opponent processing that was always going on between these churches, but they had enough that they agreed on as a base that the majority of people, including groups like the Jehovah's Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventists, Mormons, that they all could sort of participate. It was just sort of this invisible Protestant church that kind of held it together, and every now and then a leader would arise. I mentioned Reinhold Niebuhr. Someone was a little upset that I bothered to explain who Reinhold Niebuhr and H. Richard Niebuhr too, who wrote Christ and Culture, another important theologian and sort of the neo-Orthodox mid-20th century. You had these leaders who emerged, of course, Billy Graham in the evangelical world, but they sort of, it was kind of like an atomic structure where it didn't have a hard shell, sort of like old style atoms were imagined to, but there was enough movement and energy in it that it didn't collapse. And sort of what happens is that the main line decides to give up the religious game in many respects and sort of morph into kind of a secular politics. Some evangelicals sort of follow suit, and of course you had the moral majority and all of that happened, but the religious center has been collapsing while you've got immigration from other parts of the world. You've got a lot more religious pluralism going on, and so the center is sort of collapsing, and what happens, of course, is that the what's left of the main line, now that they've sort of given up religion, they continue their political effort, and that sort of becomes the blue church.
Liberal structure in place, but there's sort of a way that liberalism can become sort of a complete and totalizing worldview unto itself, arguably. But there's also ways in which other ideas can try to infuse themselves into liberalism. And I'm not sure in my.
And I think Douthat is right in that. I think that's kind of been where we've been, that Roman Catholics have tried to take a step forward and say, hey, we know how to be the center of a culture and a government. We know how to do this. Let us lead. And of course, good number of Roman Catholics on the Supreme Court. Not a lot in the White House. We've currently got a Roman Catholic in the White House, and I'll leave you Catholics to debate your guy in the White House. Of course, in many ways, the irony is that whatever church Donald Trump had in his past, it was sort of prosperity. But when I say prosperity gospel, everybody thinks of sort of Pentecostals. But Donald Trump's, Norman Vincent Peale, that was sort of prosperity mainline religion. And how to win friends and influence people, how to be successful, how to be the elite, how to guide a culture. That's Donald Trump's church inheritance, even though, he didn't go to church, which again is part of the whole collapse of the mainline. Then Donald Trump sort of starts picking up some evangelical prosperity adopters. Donald Trump is, he looks for anything that's going to suit him and he goes after it.
My own reading of the signs of the times, what is most desirable is, are you trying to sort of infuse or reinfuse liberalism with Christian ideas if you're a Christian? And I think that's generally my view because the alternatives seem more both destructive and uncertain. But I don't have the kind of visceral attachment to liberalism that you get from a lot of strong critics of post-liberalism. I think the post-liberal insight that, any society is going to have some set of governing ideas, cultures are going to be, religious in one way or another.
In other words, even if you conceptualize secular liberalism as a neutral container, the arena always has its valence, and the arena always has its implicit rules, and those implicit rules are going to push one way or another. And if you look at, let's say, Doug Wilson's videos, that's always what he's railing against, that the arena is tilted. There's no such thing as a level playing field. So evangelical Christian nationalists say you have to seize and remake it in decidedly Christian terms. I would argue that actually the arena as constructed was deeply Christian. It was also deist, because that was a big piece of the founding fathers. It was also classical. And in many ways, it served remarkably well in the United States, quite frankly. It served remarkably well. But the argument that there is no neutral arena, you're not going to get me as a presuppositionalist Calvinist to debate that. No, that is true. As Ross Douthat goes on to talk about, the question is going to be very much practical in terms of you're not asked to you don't get to just decide, especially not you by yourself or me by myself. You don't get to just decide what is the optimal form and then implement it. We got 330 million of us all in this thing together, and the rest of the world paying deep attention because it's sort of this American empire that everyone else is connected to. So everybody knows way more about American politics than Americans know about everybody else's politics. So yeah, whatever happens to this present system, it's going to be messy.
Christianity is not a private religion. If America became more Christian, American politics would inevitably become more Christian. All that seems right. So I sort of I occupy the slightly liminal position between post-liberalism and anti-post-liberalism,
Yeah,
if those terms make sense.
it's a great place to be attacked from all sides.
It
You
is, but
please
I
no
try to
one.
be. I no, I well, I certainly please no one, but I generally
Yes.
try to be.
No,
I
we feel
try
that
to be
here.
friendly. I don't have grudges. I mean, I think a lot of the discourse around post-liberalism is driven by real anger on both sides. Anger from people who are, strong defenders of liberalism who see post-liberalism as a fundamentally authoritarian threat, and then post-liberals who see liberalism as responsible for the increasing ills of our age,
And I think those aren't the only two groups. You have the other groups that say, no, we need wholesale change. It's kind of the woke left. Everything needs to be dismantled so that we can rebuild without systemic racism or systemic injustice. And we sort of get a set, you know, if we tear down the structure, then somehow we can sort of have amnesty for all the sins of evil in the past. So the truth is there's a lot of people attacking liberalism, as Tim Keller noted.
Defeat of Christianity from some perspectives and so on. And my uncertainty, I think, has saved. I don't feel that anger in either direction. But then I'm in danger of, you know, as Jesus would say, of being the sin of lukewarmness instead.
Well,
I suppose.
I'd like to return a little bit to under the surface. There's like the Jody Bottom thesis.
So that's James Woods. This is Douthat's book that read, I don't know, a couple of years ago now. This is a book that many of you have recommended to me, and I've read some of it. It's written, I believe, in 2013, and a lot has happened since then. But he covers a lot of the same territory here about sort of the collapse of the Protestant mainline and the WASPy Protestant leadership elite in the country, and how Roman Catholics sort of tried to fill in that gap and, really haven't succeeded, in good measure partly because the Roman Catholics in America are by no means a unified team, all on the same page with a unified vision as to what leadership of the country and the culture should be.
Anxious age, and you know, how do we
yep.
respond to that as Christians? I'd like to return to that in a little bit, but I'd like to maybe narrow the focus here at the beginning still on forcing you, you know, to have a take on some of the movements. But just asking even specifically more, you know, there are these alternatives to liberalism emerging. You kind of mentioned there's some anger, there's some different, you know, different viewpoints and alternatives that are emerging. And so I wanted to ask just in a narrow sense, what's your general take politically on the new right? That umbrella term, it's still broad, but it's narrowed a little bit. What's your take on the contemporary new right? Are there reasons to be hopeful about alternatives to late liberalism within that broad movement? Or do you find more reasons for concern about some of the emerging tribes, which it seems to suggest that you have some of those? And maybe,
I suppose my basic view is that the best version of the new right, meaning the most substantive and serious version, is basically within the framework of potential political options, correct in its focus. That is to say, the new right, by this I mean a new right that urges conservatives on the one hand to look seriously at, deep ills in American culture that are connected to everything from de-Christianization to the rise of the internet to the power of progressive ideology in elite institutions, and to sort of to affect take cultural politics, what gets called the culture war, seriously, not try to sidestep it, recognize that issues of sex and marriage and fertility and religion are actually some of the core issues of our time. They're not distractions from, say, you know, cutting taxes and focusing on the budget deficit.
And again, you can see this on both sides, and Douthat isn't sort of talking about stuff way to the left of them, but there's others that are saying, oh, and this is happening in the church, of course, oh, the issues really aren't sex. If the church would basically get a handle on its racism and its misogyny, then basically make the government take care of the poor, then, so, you know, there's a lot going on here with this
budget deficit. And also that while libertarianism may get a lot of discrete policy questions right, at the current moment, the spirit of libertarianism as a cultural force has carried too much before it, you know, just something like the spreading legalization of marijuana and the legalization of other drugs, right? That this is sort of a victory of libertarianism that is already yielding dark consequences, potentially disastrous consequences. And that.
And this goes to the point that I've made in the last couple of videos on the Ayla Louise Perry video and on the Kidology video, that sort of while the two battles are winning, individualism and libertarian individualism is really the one that is sort of eating up the pie. So we can't decide how, whether there should be like soft power, social power, feminine power against pornography or the sexual revolution. We can't decide that. We can't decide if there'll be overt masculine government power trying to rein in these things. So we're going to leave it to the individuals to decide. And then, but then the problem is, of course, that as a culture, we are unwilling to take that all the way. And you might say, well, what do you mean by that? Well, so homelessness is a great example. If you look at homelessness, you would say, well, as individuals, they have mental illness, they have substance abuse, they have difficult economic difficulties. That's up to the individual. So too bad. Sucks to be you. And shouldn't the government do something, or shouldn't churches or someone, shouldn't someone do something? Well, the answer, the thoroughgoing answer is no, they shouldn't do anything. Well, we don't like looking at them and panhandling and, you know, crime gets happening. Well, if they commit a crime, put them in prison and keep putting them in prison. And as a country, we look at that and we say, we don't really want to be that country. Now, we're not on the same page in terms of how exactly should we address it. Should it be churches that address it? Should it be the government that's addressed it? And in many respects, when it comes down to it, cities and counties and states are the ones, sort of the last ones holding the bag. And so then you're going to get back to sort of your programmatic secularism or your programmatic liberalism. And then you're going, well, what are the tools that we can weigh in? Well, you can have George W. Bush with his, and Obama too, with sort of their idea, well, churches can help and governments will work through churches. Or no, we don't want the government sending any kind of money to churches. So what if, you know, a 12-step program getting in touch with a higher power gets them clean, or maybe a church program where getting in touch with Jesus gets them clean? We need to have a purely secular approach to getting them clean. Maybe we'll try other drugs that will keep them off of other drugs, et cetera, and off we go.
In that case and other cases, you need a right that is willing to be sort of moralistic, judgmental and restrictive, you know, sort of to critical of vice and willing to use public policy against it. And then join that to a view of political economy that says, look, conservatism needs a view of economics that isn't just about maximizing GDP. You know, if the current phase of capitalism is, for instance, hostile to child rearing, if it's hostile to sort of industrial jobs.
And, you know, it was amazing about as the sexual revolution failed, when it gets to the end of it, basically they all say, what we really need is a culture that really welcomes pregnancy and motherhood, because all of them apparently are mothers of young boys, which was interesting, except for Barry Weiss, she has a girl. But all of the speakers on stage are mothers of young boys, and they're saying things like, well, we need a culture where people sort of, a pregnant woman or someone with a small child gets in line and sort of the line parts and ushers them to the front. And I thought, I've lived in a culture like that. That was the way it was in the Dominican Republic. My wife was pregnant often, and if we were somewhere in public, you know, Doña, con permiso, and, you know, just right up to the front of the line and the best seat on the bus. And, you know, if you were pregnant, had a small child, everybody was there for you. But this is the culture of the Dominican Republic. This had plenty of machismo, and this was sort of an oligarchy, and this had enormous income inequality as a culture and massive amounts of poverty. And so it's like, oh, so maybe mothers and mothers with small children will get shown great deference, but you have to sort of ramp up the machismo masculinity if you want that. Is that the trade-off you want? So,
That men especially might you know, work at, and, you know, as wage earners, and be able to support the as family and so on. Those are areas where the right, where conservatives need to support a more, sometimes a more activist government. And again, not just sort of default, not so much even to libertarianism as just to a kind of like rote supply side economics policy agenda, where all you're trying to do is lower the corporate tax rate, lower the top marginal tax rate, and assume that everything else will take care of itself. So I think combining those two ideas, which, to be clear, actually, I mean,
you know, it's quite interesting that, you know, what Douthat sort of lays out there, I think in many ways has subsided, because that those were themes I heard from conservatives 10, 15, 20 years ago. Now all the energy on conservatism isn't sort of, you know, let the market sort it out. It's much more activistic, which is a way, again, in terms of René Girard, these two groups begin to mirror each other as they continue to combat one another. And the activism on the left, the activists, people become activists on the right in order to contend with activists on the left. And again, the opponent processing just continues to scale.
For me, these are ideas I've held for in some form for most of my professional life. I think they're more urgent at the moment. And I think, again, yeah, that's where I think the new right at its best ends up. And that's a good thing. That being said, I think that whether that actually cashes out in a workable agenda for Republican governance of the United States is very much an open question. And I think the strong temptation of the new right, as of many aspects of the right in the age of Trump, is towards a kind of empty posturing, a kind of empty culture warring, a sort of very online politics where, you know, you aren't trying to figure out how to revive marriage and family. You just are going to, you know, own the libs in various ways. And, you know, I don't really see the new right as capable of setting up an authoritarian dictatorship. I think it probably does have some temptations.
And, you know, the own the libs in various ways. And this is many ways what sort of things have devolved to. Well, you can make a lot of money owning the libs, set up your entire network on liberal tiers, and just keep owning the libs, and you just keep feeding that. But does it go anywhere? It's just a spectacle.
Some temptations in that direction, but that's not really my primary worry. My primary worry is more sort of chaos, misgovernment, and a spirit of crisis, which I think was where the Trump White House often ended up, rather than the dark night of authoritarianism descending. Owning the libs as governance, I think, is a strategy that at best yields chaos, and doesn't deliver on the actual promises of the new right at its best.
Yeah, I think you're using some of the language that you use in your writing on decadence there in the last couple of minutes. Which are you saying that the new right at its worst is gets caught up in the decadence of contemporary society and becomes just another expression of that decadence instead of a resistance to it?
Yes, I think that's fair. I think the new right is not the only one, but one form of politics that has emerged as a reaction against stagnation, sort of torpor, you know, repetition, the things that I describe as decadence, declining birth rates, all these kind of things. I think in the world of 2013, there was really no reaction against these forces. And I think a lot of things, new right, Bernie Sanders socialism, even wokeness to some degree, are attempts to sort of grapple with decadence and sort of reinvigorate Western society or American society, restore moral purpose, these kinds of things. And obviously, I think the new right diagnosis is closest to the truth of the situation. I'm not a Sanders socialist. But yes, to your point, I think there are many ways that decadence is a very powerful force, and it's very easy to sort of rage against decadence in ways that are themselves just empty. The empty spasms of a society that's stuck.
And you have a funny relationship to decadence too, right? Because you, in some senses, you've mentioned in various places that you prefer it, right, to certain radical alternatives that can go in pretty dark directions. But I maybe that might be an opportunity for us to transition to the Christian responses to.
And this sort of is okay, so maybe we don't want to rat. Maybe this is sort of the anti-activist element that maybe stalemate is better than losing, or even winning and then losing after you win, because the backlash is so severe.
Some of these things, because one of the things you were discussing there, you didn't use these terms, but I basically was hearing you say like the positive that you're steel manning with the new right is gesturing at, right, is basically like a form of trying to actually bring in the various facets of Catholic social teaching that often get neglected in contemporary kind of conservative politics or whatever, and obviously also on the left, but but so you mentioned that we've entered almost a time where at least political ideas are challenging, are not just stuck in the decadence. Maybe their practice execution is, but maybe now we can at least pivot to some of those ideas because you've done a really gr you've done great work. I think some of one of your great gifts, as you mentioned earlier, is explaining emergent developments, especially to an audience that would probably be hostile to them. Our audience is probably less hostile to at least this part of the conversation, but they're probably unfamiliar with some of the terms that you've used. And I'm referring to you, I think.
I'm going to jump forward in this a little bit.
Could I go back to something you said earlier, Ross? And this is a kind of a would be a I suppose an integralist counter. You said that the American system is a container, and that different sorts of it can contain different sorts of movements and agendas, and once it was the Protestant mainline, now it's wokeness or something like that. That's it, within the container, this procedural container. I mean, the argument of the integralist would be, in part, that's just the problem, that liberalism is just a container. And then the other aspect of the critique would be, in fact, it's not just a container, but the structures themselves provide incentives for certain kinds of things to emerge. It's not an integralist, but DC Schindler talks about, or actually it's David L. Schindler talked about the liberal order has to be policed. Somebody has to decide what is permitted and what's not permitted, and those decisions are not neutral decisions. The umpire has some stake in the decisions that he's making. So how would you respond to those kind of critiques of the American system from the more radical post-liberals?
Well, I mean, I think that they obviously capture some real truth, right? Which is that liberalism, the liberal container, sort of left to its own devices, tends towards various forms of individualism, tends to encourage various forms of individualism, an individualism of the market and an individualism of the self, right? And so
And when you look at, again, it was interesting watching them debate the sexual revolution, struggling to sort of say, okay, well, what is the essence of the sexual revolution? And in the end, it comes down to individuals get to try to do what they want. Okay. But then are you going to then have society come around and make society responsible, make history responsible for the negative consequences of going out and actually doing what you wanted to do? In other words, I think Douthat is right. There's a deep individualism, and this particular form is slanted towards individualism.
You can see the period in certain ways of, 1960 through 2010 as the waning of the old, the sort of old Protestant system, its collapse, its attempted replacement by a kind of, evangelical Catholic alliance, the religious right of the Reagan era and the George W. Bush era. The failure of that effort And in the failure of that effort, the triumph of a kind of homo economicus, where, you know, a sort of where the assumption is you're a consumer, you're a sort of nurturer of this private self. There's a kind of implicit Gnosticism, right? That, you know, the sort of there's a kind of secret you that you need, everyone needs to get in touch with. That's, you know, the god within themselves.
It's the secret sacred self. We have a name for this, Ross. You should learn the name and use it. It's the secret sacred self.
And this is sort of becomes a big, it's always.
And this again with the Hans-Georg Müller, you go from sincerity, which I'm not sure it's the great choice of word, but basically your duty is to fulfill your traditional roles in family and society, to authenticity, where it's trying to express the secret sacred self. And now we're leaving that because it's sort of being blown away by social media. The secret sacred self looks increasingly difficult to find. And so all we have left is pro-felicity and inhabiting the screens all over with horcrux of ourselves.
Been there in American religion, but becomes a bigger and bigger part of it as Christianity diminishes. So I think that account is fair, that those trends are in some way reflective of certain incentives within the liberal system. I think that the response from someone who is not a fully convinced post-liberal might be twofold, right? One is to say that, okay, you know, is this, yes, this is things have worked out in this particular way. But have they worked out in this particular way simply because of, you know, sort of philosophical ideas contained in John Locke or James Madison that inevitably were going to work out this way? Or is it that Christianity was in fact quite capable of policing American liberalism until we invented the interstate highway, the birth control pill, and the internet, right? And so then you get these various technological shocks that weaken Christianity in various ways, but it's not clear that, you know, if that sort of there's a philosophical answer to them immediately.
And again, I think this is correct, that so much of what has happened has been this combination of technology and power coming into this liberal space where the individual becomes in many ways increasingly more powerful, and this power has been given to more and more and more individuals through the internet, through the computer, through wealth, that the individualism continues to go. But of course, as the individuals expand, we start bumping up into each other because human beings are individuals, but we're also part of these bodies and these collectives and these identities and these participations. And so all of the pressure just continues to mount. And again, so when you get to this question of the sexual revolution, all of the externalities begin to well up and people begin to have questions about, well, maybe this isn't a good thing, but nobody on the stage really has any solution for it. Because any solution would have to, in the individual sphere, have to be taken on by the individual, would have to be a renunciation themselves, and that renunciation would have to take a communal form, which of course churches are used to doing, and other religious groups are used to doing renunciation at a communal form. But those are all the tensions that have been present in the liberationist narratives that have been going on for the last 150 years.
Immediately, so much as just sort of they create social problems that need new strategies of evangelization, church building, and all kinds of things like that, right? Like, I think it's an open question whether the sexual revolution and all its aftermath is best understood as certain liberal ideas working themselves out or certain changes in economics and technology creating challenges that, regardless of political philosophy, the Christian churches haven't figured out a way to address yet. So that would be one point. The other point is just that...
I want to get there. I thought that was just absolutely correct, that you have all of these changes and Christian churches, the Christian communities, change is coming so fast that all of the, I mentioned the other day in a Brando's, an unrecorded Brando's conversation, you know, the Protestantism is sort of this laboratory. All these things are tried in Protestant groups and these ideas die, but things are happening so quickly that it's very, very hard. Once you actually find something that seems to work for the Christian community, having that thing sort of spread and help, I mean, it's tremendous research, development, and deployment challenge that the churches are dealing with, while the churches as a group have less and less influence, power, money, institutional solidity.
We are here, right? We are in a society structured in this way, with this attempt to sort of create a structure for managing pluralism. And I don't think you should assume that this is the best society, the perfect society, or anything like that, but it is the society we have. It is the constitution we have. It's the political order we have. And if you want to propose, if you think this political order is corrupt at the root, then you need to propose solutions and changes commensurate with that corruption, right? You can't just say, you know, liberalism is rotten and was always going to end where we've ended up, and the solution is to pass laws restricting pornography. I mean, I'm in favor of laws restricting pornography, but that doesn't take us out of liberalism. Liberalism has allowed for laws restricting pornography in the past. You need to be willing to say, well, we need to repeal the First Amendment and not have a soft establishment of religion of the kind that I think liberalism allows, but a hard establishment of religion and so forth. And there are some integralists who are willing to just say this. I think if you say that, you are in a position that is still fairly politically irrelevant to the current situation. But then you have other people who are not quite willing to say that. And so it leaves this kind of radical posture, but without a actual fully post-liberal agenda, right?
And I think in many ways, that's what sort of reigns on YouTube, is the posture. Because there's a sense of panic. And then what you look for is, well, these people are addressing the sense of panic. Okay, so I'm going to listen to them. But there's the sense of panic. There's the cause of the panic. And these people are talking about the panic, but nothing is actually helping. Again, this drives politics. And so then we're going to listen to, well, he's against it, but she's against it louder. And her words are more dramatic, and her words are more, and his words have a sharper meme. And you just have this heightening of rhetoric, but it doesn't mean anybody has any solution. It doesn't mean that, I mean, this is why, you know, to a certain degree, I say, okay, Moscow, Idaho, call me when you get to Boise. You can make clever YouTubes on the internet all day long, and well, good, you know, get a few thousand people in your church. This is a nation of 330 million people. I was gotta be careful here. I was driving someone somewhere, I'll say it that way, and going to a thing, and this thing was happening. It wasn't a religious thing. It was a social welfare thing, but a church was doing it, a different church than mine. And I pull into the parking lot and I see a street racer with this a big Sikh emblem hanging from the mirror. And it was just, in 2003, Time magazine called this little corner of Sacramento the most diverse area in America. There is so much economic diversity, so much religious diversity, so much thought and idea diversity right here. You have so many religions, and they're all right here. And I just thought, I was listening to this while I was doing that driving, and I thought, yeah, most of this doesn't scale well, because part of what took down the Christian nationalism of the mid-20th century was it's too much of American society could not participate. Black Protestants were sort of on the out. Catholics were on the out. Orthodox weren't even named. Muslims were such a tiny group. In the counterculture, then, in the 60s and 70s, you have sort of American New Age religiosity with Hinduism, Buddhism. My neighbor right next door is originally, is ethnically, he's Indian, and religiously, he's Hindu, but he lived for a while in Fiji, and then, you know, a couple of decades ago, Fiji decided that there were way too many Indians running around, and so they kicked them all out. Fiji for the Fijians. Now, that's a tiny little island, and I had this piece about Abraham Kuyper before. You know, where's Abraham Kuyper now? But the Netherlands at the beginning of the 20th century, with maybe 5 million people, of which maybe half are Reformed, and Reformed's kind of splintered, but you've got the Roman Catholics there to kind of give the Reformed a bit of cohesion. At least we're not Catholic. And so Abraham Kuyper, you know, founds a newspaper, founds a university, gets elected prime minister, not for very many years, sort of establishes this way to address the little bit of pluralism that was in the Netherlands at the beginning of the 20th century, polarization. And when you look at something like the United States through the eyes of the multiple nations, the Deep South, the New France, the Midlanders, the Greater Appalachia, Yankeedom, the Far West, El Norte, the Left Coast, all of these different nations, you know, I have deep respect for Aaron Wren, and he talks about, you know, Christians. He's sort of anti-populist when it comes to, he's not anti-populist, but he's saying populism isn't going to do it. You need elites, you need institutions if you're actually going to have this. But how, in many ways, America worked because Protestantism by its nature, and you can see this in the way that evangelicalism isn't one denomination. It's this amalgam of denominations that have enough in common to build a degree of cohesion. And to a certain degree, the American political parties are always doing this too. But then to have a religiosity which, you know, again, kidology, I thought there was a brilliant way of saying these fads become these sort of these micro religions. I thought that was exactly right. And that those little micro religions tend to last us a decade. But that's really hard in terms of cohesion through time.
Agenda, right? Like, how do you get from here to the Empire of Guadalupe, right? To take the sort of joking or is it phrase that gets thrown around, right? Like the North American, the most holy North American union of, you know, et cetera, right? Like America is a pluralist society. It's not a Catholic society. It's a Protestant society, maybe at its root, that's now deeply pluralist. You're not going to impose Catholicism through the force of, you know, whatever institution within current modes of government. So what in fact are we really talking about with this critique? And that's what I'm uncertain about, but I feel like I'm often prodding post-liberals and integralists to sort of say more fully what they mean or think on that front.
I think that's a good point too.
And I think Douthat is dead on right there, that most of what people are sort of proposing, okay, we can get together to, you know, keep penises out of women's bathrooms and locker rooms, and we can get together to maybe put some more limits on abortion, and we can sort of, these sort of then become these tiny micro religions that may all sort of get around, and that's sort of, again, the Protestant way. But as modernity recedes and liberalism gets threadbare, that sort of lowest common denominator that was sufficient to sort of keep an amalgam of semi-cohesive cultures together, even given all of the diversity, the historical diversity of these states. Let's see if I can pull up that. Yeah, there's the map. To sort of keep all of this thing together, well, wow. It's amazing we've done as well as we've done so far. You know, part of what I've been thinking about watching the Middle Eastern conflict is, you know, for a long time, the two-state solution, and that increasingly seems to be dying a death, and its time has come and gone, but there's no viable alternative. But what you wind up having in terms of a map of the world, and last year, my trip to Europe, it was the first time I'd ever been in Europe. I mean, I was just sort of shocked that, okay, we were in the Netherlands, and then we drove out of the Netherlands, and then we were in Germany, and we're down or Frankfurt, and so we're heading to Mannheim. That's where the event is in Mannheim, and these are tiny places. And, well, the UK, they're an island, so they have different money, and they have a different language, and you know, in Amsterdam and in the Netherlands, I can sort of use my phone to pay for things. But once we got to Germany, it was like cash is king. And it's probably because of the taxes. But you see all of these little countries, you know, all of these tiny little places. And you say, this is the answer? All these tiny little nations? And this sort of works because, well, you've got, you know, Russia and Ukraine. I mean, to what degree can Ukraine actually continue to hold off the Russians? Well, obviously only with the help of, you know, Germany and America and a bunch of other things. But and you've got, so yeah, you want to have America sort of devolve into all of these little nations. Well, that's not really going to work so well. And I mean, just look at Canada. You know, the Midlands sort of start in lower New Jersey and go all the way to Nebraska and then go up through Iowa and the Dakotas and, you know, Ontario. And there's a reason people want to be part of a bigger thing, because if you're part of a smaller thing, bigger things are going to eat you. You know, even just the tip of Florida, part of Spanish Caribbean. Yeah. That's right, El Norte. I was listening to a Peter Zeeland thing, and he was talking about how, yeah, El Norte is fairly, he didn't use that term, but El Norte is fairly well, but if America's going to no longer have China to outsource our cheap manufacturing, Mexico is sort of the next best place to find the labor, but we don't have all of the rail ties further, you know, further deeper into Mexico, into Mexico City and into El Sur in Mexico. So, I mean, yeah. Well, I would definitely recommend listening to the whole thing. There's lots more good stuff. It's a great podcast. Check it out. Add it to your diet. I haven't listened to some of the earlier episodes. Oh, Brad Littlejohn, I know him. DC Schindler is on there. So, yeah, it's very much right up the alley of a lot of people here in the corner, at least those who want to talk about the thinky-talky political type things. So check it out, have a listen, leave a comment. The pace of videos is going to change soon. Some people are organizing something for Wednesday next week in terms of Amsterdam, maybe Thursday in The Hague, and then Friday to Sunday is the German festival. Links are down below. After the German festival, I fly to London and participate in Peterson's ARC conference. And after that, I don't know if you've got ideas or if you've got a estuary or something, contact Tayo. Find him on the Discord server. Tayo and John Lumgar, I think, are sort of putting things together. Someone mentioned, you know, come up to Edinburgh. So if things don't fill in too much, I'd like to get over again to Oxford to see some Lewis stuff. So I've got a few days in the UK before I leave, and hopefully if you're in the UK, we can sort of ad hoc organize some things and I can get to see some of you again or see some of you for the first time. probably sort of in an estuary format. I think that's probably how we'll do it. So yeah, video production is going to slow down. I'm probably going to try to post a bunch of stuff in the membership section. Again, more personal stuff. I'll probably do some conversations with some people there. And yeah, so the pattern of the channel will change. And then after 2 weeks, continue back more as it is. So leave a comment. Let me know what you think.